Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and we have, I think, a very interesting podcast in store for you. We're going to be talking about the food industry and how the food industry undermines our health systematically. We're going to talk to an expert in the field of public health. She's an advocate specializing in legal strategies to counter corporate tactics that attempt to undermine the public's health. She is Michelle Simon. She has a law degree from the University of California. She also has a master's in public health degree from Yale University, superb qualifications, and she's been battling on behalf of better food policies as a consumer advocate since 1996. She has been awarded the National Association of Nutrition Professionals Community Award and the Nutritional Therapy Association's Award of Excellence, and she is author of a great book entitled Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. And welcome to Intelligent Medicine, Michelle. It's nice having you as our guest.
Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So tell us a little bit about your organization. What is that about? Eat, Drink, Politics.
Sure. Well, it's a consulting firm that specializes in researching and writing about food industry practices and food policy and, to some extent, the alcohol industry. And really what the idea is to shine a light on those particularly egregious practices of the industry that go to issues like marketing to children, lobbying to obstruct public policy, whether that's labeling of genetically engineered foods or trying to, curb marketing to children. So really looking at those industry practices that are undermining both our health and public policy in general.
And you have a fantastic website at eatdrinkpolitics.com, and there you can find a whole bunch of reports, lots of information. You talk about GMOs, you talk about the food industry. Let's start off with your reaction to the new farm bill. I thought I might start the program by touching a nerve, because the new farm bill just got passed, and everybody's very happy that we finally got something passed in Congress. At least there's a consensus that we ought to continue with agricultural subsidies and more or less continuing our food stamp program, although the bill has been criticized because there have been some slight cutbacks. What's your take on that?
Right. Well, yeah, Congress got it together after almost 2 years of not getting it together, so the 2012 Farm Bill got passed in 2014, mostly due to arguments over what could have been much deeper cuts to the food stamp program, now known as SNAP. The Republicans wanted many, many billions of dollars to be cut, wound up being much less severe than was originally proposed, so that's some good news. But the bad news is that the agriculture subsidy system will pretty much continue as business as usual. Some minor reforms, but the same treadmill of promoting and favoring all the wrong kinds of crops, such as soy and corn, that go into our heavy meat-centered and processed food diet at the expense of the more healthful food crops known as specialty crops. That's what we have to call fruits and vegetables. Those will continue to get supported and a much pennies on the dollar compared to the conventional crops. So, this is the treadmill system of conventional agriculture that really feeds into our very unhealthy diet. And, here we are in another 5 years of the same policies in that farm bill.
So, I mean, it is a matter of public policy. We want to support the farmers. That's great. Farmers are great people. Paul Harvey did that wonderful elegiac radio broadcast about farmers are the salt of the earth. So farm bills are very popular, particularly among Midwestern senators and congressmen and women. And yet it seems that the very crops that we subsidize, we're subsidizing obesity and ill health in America. How does that actually work?
Well, like I said, the inputs to the standard American diet are mostly come in the form of grain. So corn and soy go into feeding animals, and it keeps those inputs very cheap. So the conventional animal producers buy the corn and soy to go into the animal feed, and that's what helps produce, you know, a cheap hamburger at McDonald's. Similarly, the corn syrup that goes into sugar production, the byproduct of corn production,
high fructose corn syrup, right?
Right.
Yeah, so we made that very cheap and economical. I mean, it used to be there was some problems with sugar. You know, we lost Cuba and much of Latin America, which used to be our sources of sugar, but we came up with something, and it's so cheap that we make it into gasoline now.
Right, right. Well, that's a different problem, actually. Diverting corn production for ethanol is an incredibly stupid policy, but it actually keeps corn prices higher than they would otherwise be. It's such a twisted system. And then soy is also used in animal feed, but also a byproduct in processed food. And, of course, wheat is in many processed foods. So it's just these types of commodity grains continue to get the lion's share of subsidies. And you're right, we're not saying subsidies are bad. It's just that we're subsidizing the wrong kinds of foods that are contributing to our public health problems due to poor diet.
Well, can't we achieve some kind of consensus that it's healthy to eat fresh fruits and vegetables and maybe give some subsidies to broccoli growers or cranberry farmers? Wouldn't that be the ideal world?
That would be nice. Yeah, it would be nice. I mean, we certainly have scientific consensus. I mean, it's so ironic that on, you know, one end of our U.S. Department of Agriculture subsidizing all the wrong inputs to agriculture oils, on the other side of the building, you know, they're promoting the 5 a day, whatever it is now, 9 a day, fresh fruits and vegetables, which are telling Americans to eat a healthier diet. But there's a large gulf in between the two, known as politics. That's a large problem.
Well, I read some statistics, I believe it was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, on the SNAP program, a.k.a. food stamps. And the problem is, I mean, we hope that it's going to stave off starvation and poverty, and certainly it's going to alleviate some economic pressure on people who scrounge to put a meal on the table. That's good, because, you know, if that's, you know, your daily toil to find food for your family, that is a meager existence indeed. But when we look at the nutritional outcome, it's kind of bleak, because it turns out that according to some studies, you know, perhaps these are the wrong studies, other studies may controvert this, it turns out that individuals who are utilizing SNAP compared to people who are of comparable incomes who don't access SNAP are heavier, more prone to diabetes, prediabetes, metabolic syndrome, we'll call it what you will. They're less healthy because, unfortunately, under SNAP, you can buy pretty much any darn kind of junk food. Am I wrong?
Well, actually, the data is a little bit more complicated than that, and there are people who will swear up and down that people who are on SNAP aren't any less healthy than the average American and don't even eat much worse than the average American. But my answer to that is, well, that's really bad news, because, as we know, most Americans are not doing very well and certainly are not eating right. And so, look, the point is that if people on SNAP are eating similarly to the rest of America, then we've got a problem. And the problem is worse than usual, because in this case, we have a government tax program that's essentially subsidizing the diet of junk food that most Americans eat, and particularly with the population of people who can least afford to get sick. And so, you know, the way I like to frame the issue is not, you know, I don't want to blame poor people for how they're choosing to eat. The problem is that we're subsidizing the pockets of Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, and Mars Candy and the rest, instead of promoting a program for nutrition purposes. You know, I always like to say that N in SNAP stands for nutrition.
Right.
And how can we maximize this program to really help people eat a truly healthy diet, many of whom want to be eating healthier, just don't have access, don't, you know, have the stores even to buy fresh food.
Well, the big corporate giants like Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and, you know, companies that make sugary foods, Kraft foods, and so on, General Foods, you name it, they're not contributing to the Tea Party to abolish food stamps. They're actually, many of them are very happy with the current regime that has expanded food benefits, because it's kind of like hand in glove. It's like, okay, let's help the poor people, but oh, by the way, it's a big subsidy for their selling often poor quality food.
Yes, and that's exactly how they position it, that, oh, you know, this is something we want to help people on SNAP, or, you know, don't tell poor people how to eat. Meanwhile, it's, you know, obviously a bit of a conflict of interest for a company like Coca-Cola to be making that kind of an argument. But they do team up with anti-hunger groups that want to see the program continue. So, you know, a wonderful alliance has formed between the likes of PepsiCo and Walmart and anti-hunger groups to keep this program going and not make any improvements to it.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was an issue of, you know, Bloomberg in New York, of course, wanted to, you know, he was really trying to reform the eating habits of New Yorkers. And there was an attempt, I think, in New York to limit the types of food choices that food stamp recipients could make. But they slapped him down. They said, look, you can't make that determination locally. This is a federal policy. Don't mess with a federal policy. And pretty much, you know, so you ended up not being able to modify the choices. I believe you can, you know, if you want, you can get a, you know, 64-ounce bottle of soda with food stamps. Am I mistaken?
Yes, there are very few exclusions to what retailers can sell under the food stamp program, and those consist mainly of items that we would expect, like tobacco or alcohol.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty obvious
pretty much
things.
Any
yeah.
food program.
Right.
Pretty much any food product can be sold under the food stamp program, and what happened was, with the New York situation, was that New York actually applied for what would legally be considered a waiver from USDA to be able to simply pilot a program in New York City to not allow retailers to sell soda for food stamps. And the federal government said, no, we're not going to grant that waiver. And a number of states have applied or have passed bills to you know, attempt to do something similar, but they get slapped back, too, mostly in the lobbying process, because again, the same big food companies don't want to see those types of laws passed. So, you know, this is a problem that will continue as we grapple for solutions to our public health crisis. And having a government program that, you know, actually takes up most of the farm bill, the food stamp program is the nutrition title of the of that farm bill is actually almost 80% of the funding, which is huge. I mean, like I said, approaching $80 billion a year because so many people need the food stamp program, so why not put that program into in a better direction to truly serve people with good nutrition?
Well, you know, your kind of initiative is in the news because you presumably you know about this. A story was just released yesterday. Dateline London. Governments could slow or even reverse the growing obesity epidemic if they introduced more regulation into the global market for fast food, such as burgers, chips, and fizzy drinks, researchers said on Monday. The guy who is spearheading this is not too far away from you. I believe you're in California. He's Roberto De Fogli of the University of California, Davis. He led the study for the World Health Organization, and what they're saying is that we've got a free fire zone when it comes to regulation. You know, nobody likes government regulation. You know, when Bloomberg, you know, undertook to limit the size of sodas, people were up in arms. They didn't want a nanny state. But what's the solution? Because if you got a free fire zone and the corporates are running things, and we know that they actually design food to be caloric and addictive and scrumptious, and without, you know, our national health priorities in mind.
Right. Well, the food industry has done a very good job at painting this picture of the nanny state just for, you know, daring to propose that the food industry be reined in just a little bit from its aggressive marketing practices. But, you know, if you think about the way we deal with regulation in general, it's not that different from, you know, curbing pollution in our waterways or in our, you know, air. I mean, we realized way back in the 70s under President Nixon that we needed to start controlling pollution because it was, you know, people were getting sick from drinking water and so forth. And yet we don't, you know, since then, there's been such a rollback in this idea of government simply striking a balance between our economic engine and public health that people forget that, you know, it was because of those types of regulations that were put in place that we breathe clean air and drink clean water. And so, you know, we're just saying, well, how about having a similar approach when it comes to the food industry, which is definitely polluting the food supply, certainly polluting the airwaves with all of its aggressive marketing messages, and people are very sick as a result.
Well, you say, you know, aggressive marketing messages. One of the initiatives of Eat Drink Politics has to do with marketing to children. How are we doing on that front? Because, you know, every time I turn on the cartoons in the morning, I don't see a lot of good nutrition coming across during the commercial breaks.
Yeah, no, not so much. Well, we're doing pretty dismally, I'm sorry to report. Despite there being advocacy on this issue for a number of years, the food industry teamed up with the media conglomerates have done a very good job of keeping the status quo, and that is mainly in targeting younger and younger children. And, of course, it's not just on TV these days. It's on every digital device and everywhere a child goes. They're potentially bombarded with advertisements to eat all the wrong kinds of foods. And it's because the food industry knows damn well that you have to get to kids as young as possible to get them hooked on their products, to get them to have brand loyalty, you know, to get them to choose Coke over Pepsi, get them to choose McDonald's over Burger King, et cetera. The younger a child makes that kind of decision or gets, you know, emotionally attached to a brand, then the more likely that child will stick with that brand for life. And that's really what it's about. It's about the battle for young, you know, vulnerable children's minds.
You know, I've heard it said that people are contemplating a legal angle to this, and the headline is sugar the new tobacco? And because now we have studies that link sugar and soda consumption to adult obesity, diabetes, and heart disease, and the science is there. It's a little bit like it was in the 1950s when we started to have the science showing that cigarettes are actually bad for you. You know, actually in the 50s we had advertisements. Doctors would be wearing their doctor's coat smoking Camel cigarettes, and they would say this is the brand that 9 out of 10 doctors choose, because I guess people were oblivious to the hazards of cigarettes, and then the industry was covering it up. But more and more we're seeing there really is the smoking gun link between consumption of refined carbohydrates, sugar, sodas, and disease. Is there a possibility of a legal angle to call these corporations to account?
Well, you know, I guess being a lawyer, I always have to take an approach that everything is legal. I mean, every public policy is law. So, you know, when you say legal, you probably mean litigation.
Litigation, yeah, mean, yeah, like the, you know,
okay.
Right. Like when they have like billions of dollars set aside in settlements for people who came to harm because of smoking, and they claim they were not made aware of it. And, you know, I hate to see that is the way that we change things in America with huge lawsuits that, you know, basically enrich law firms, not so much the people. But it does influence policy, and it has had an impact on smoking in America.
Well, I would first of all question that premise. I mean, most litigation that goes on is business suing other businesses. There's very little relative litigation of, you know, lawyers suing on behalf of clients and then getting rich. And litigation was a very effective tool against the tobacco industry, not even to make anyone a lot of money, but to get them to change their practices and to put money into a settlement fund to help mm-hmm. public health.
Right, so now they can advertise with warnings. There's actually
a with food really is yet to be seen, and it's probably the answer is no, because food is much more complicated than tobacco. I mean, this whole obsession with sugar right now, I think, is, you know, I mean, it's nothing new that sugar is addicting, and that soda is bad for you, but, you know, it's kind of the latest bandwagon that people want to jump on. But it's really the entire American diet that's the problem, and sugar is one component to it. And I don't really see anything about sugar per se that makes it similar enough to tobacco to mm-hmm. have the kinds of lawsuits that we saw. It's just a completely different situation.
Right. It would be hard to make that linear connection to disease and death and damages. You also have looked at the issue of food labeling, which is really heating up. I mean, talk about a populist rebellion. So many people across the country are saying, hey, you're giving us these GMO foods, genetically engineered foods, the GMO or GE foods, depending on your terminology. And it's the position of Eat Drink Politics, I think, that we should have labeling, and that makes sense, correct?
Yeah, well, we have a mass movement in this country for labeling, which is why I've been following it. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous that GMO labeling has been accomplished in 64 other countries, but we still don't have it in this country or in Canada. And, you know, people want to know. People have a right to know what they're eating, that these foods have been genetically altered. They contain ingredients that cannot be found in nature, and yet many of these products are labeled natural. But look, if Monsanto can get a patent on GMO corn, then it's certainly not natural. So, you know, I think that people just do have a right to know, and it's just a matter of time before industry, you know, it gets tired of these fights, because we've had a number of them now, and they're not going to keep fighting state by state. What they're probably going to do is get some kind of watered-down federal solution, policy solution that I've, you know, been writing about too, and that, but we'll see what happens. But absolutely,
you're making a prediction here, Michelle, that we will have labeling, but you think that the whole labeling process will be somehow co-opted or watered down by industry, because they're going to get smart.
It's been made public by me and some others that industries, at least the industries trade group, Grocery Manufacturers Association, I mean, they've been, their documents have been made public now to show that that is their game plan, mm-hmm. that they don't want to have to keep spending millions of dollars on these state-level fights, that they're trying to get their friends in Congress to pass a watered-down, you know, labeling measure, get FDA to just talk about voluntary labeling, I mean, something that is so ridiculous and far from what advocates want. But that's, you know, possibly what's coming, and it'll just depend on the food movement's muscle to stop that kind of thing from coming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because, I mean, they're smart. They know that there's going to be a public demand by some, you know, albeit a minority of people making that choice. And, they want to get ahead of this issue because this issue is bad public relations for them.
Yep, very much so. I mean, their members have been really on the receiving end of a lot of negative publicity, and particularly companies that own organic or natural brands, which increasingly with consolidation, they do. So a company like General Mills that makes all kinds of, you know, disgusting sugary cereals also owns Cascadian Farms, an organic, mostly vegetable company. So, you know, people are upset when they find out that their favorite organic brands is owned by a big conglomerate that's fighting GMO labeling, and that's not good PR for any of these companies. So it will come to an end in the next couple of years.
Yeah, we see sort of token efforts on behalf of natural, or, you know, they're trying to kind of get with the program. Well, for example, there's gluten-free Cheerios now, because taking advantage of the gluten-free craze. But, to my mind, oats have always been gluten-free, so I don't think that's the biggest deal in the world.
Well, actually, oats aren't necessarily gluten-free.
As a medical doctor, I'll tell you, some people, you know, may have problems, or if it's not properly processed, you know, it can be a problem for some people with celiac disease, true. But, you know, they're making that claim, and I guess that they're trying to draft on the popularity of the gluten-free diet.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, it's just the latest health-washing bandwagon. I mean, I've seen gluten-free claims on Fritos corn chips, I mean, it's absurd. So, yeah, you're right, to just take any old processed food and label it gluten-free, or even to take a non-processed food and label it gluten-free is just silly. So, but that's what companies do. They want to just, you know, make money with marketing claims and not by actually selling healthy food.
Low fat, low carb, you know, I've seen various types of meat products being advertised as low carb. Well, duh. You know, they are low carb. One of your targets at Eat Drink Politics, drink products that are aimed at kids that contain high levels of caffeine, or some of these starter drinks that are sort of like sugary soda pop things laced with alcohol. You have a problem with that?
Yeah, I've done a lot of work on what you're talking about, which are called alcopops and popular parlance. So they're basically soft drinks laced with alcohol, and they're in theory intended for legal age drinking adults, but the marketing plan and their flavoring, and I mean, they're so sweet, you know, most adults couldn't stand them, is obviously aimed at underage youth, and underage drinking remains a serious problem in this country, as is binge drinking in general among adults. But, you know, we don't tend to pay attention to that in public health circles enough, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, the way I look at it, you know, the soft drink companies kind of get kids started on craving and acclimating their palates to sugary beverages, and then they kind of get handed off to the alcohol industry, you know, in somewhere in their teenage years, where they then take that sugary palate and simply add alcohol to it.
Well, you see, it's sort of a gateway drug, in effect, to alcohol consumption mm-hmm. later.
Yeah, and actually there's been research to show the connection between proclivity for sugar and alcohol. It's like, you know, why some programs to get help get you off alcohol will actually offer a sugary candy to help with that craving.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's a deep connection between sugar consumption and alcohol, which, you know, again, unfortunately my colleagues in public health just tend to focus on the soft drinks when, you know, there's just as much, even bigger public health disaster going on regarding alcohol.
How about, you know, we used to have a lot of caffeine in the cola drinks, so plenty of caffeine there. But now we have these supercharged drinks. We've got Monster Beverage, and we got Red Bull, and all manner of copycats and clones. Do you take that on at Eat Drink Politics?
Yeah, well, I've certainly written about the problems of energy drinks, and, you know, this is another kind of falling through the cracks a little bit. I mean, there's definitely advocates talking about soda, but these highly caffeinated soft drinks are becoming a bigger problem. You know, companies aggressively market them, like Monster and Red Bull, and there's been some effort to rein them in. Through litigation, the city of San Francisco filed a lawsuit against Monster Energy Drinks, and then I know that there's some other state-level attorneys general that are investigating these same companies for unfairly targeting youth. So hopefully we'll see some more of that kind of activity, because it's, you know, it's really irresponsible, and we're seeing teenagers having the effects of consuming these highly caffeinated drinks, being admitted to the hospital. One girl died. She had a heart condition, and she died from consuming too much of this type of beverage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's there are always tragedies that occur in vulnerable kids. You talk a lot about how the food industry is sort of co-opting science. You know, whenever there's a study that soft drinks, you know, cause whatever, attention deficit disorder, or cause increase the risk for diabetes and obesity, they always seem to come up with an expert for hire, or they'll commission a study that says, no, it ain't so, that it can, you know, drink plenty of soft drinks in conjunction with an active lifestyle. That's the favorite. That's the mantra. It's like, you know, you drink plenty of that, you know, it's like drink, guzzle Gatorade, and remain active, and it won't impact you. I mean, are you perturbed by the fact that they've got so much power and so much money that they have science at their behest?
Well, this is another trick right out of the tobacco industry playbook, right? If you don't like the science, just buy some of your own.
Mm-hmm.
So the soft drink industry has found ways to pay off researchers to, you know, invent science in their benefit and then put that out there. Certainly the artificial sweetener industry is the master.
Yes, absolutely.
At doing that, confusing the science, yes. And then, you know, engaging in all kinds of distractions with public relations. Like you mentioned, the exercise one. Coca-Cola has a whole campaign to imply that all you need to do is, you know, walk your dog after you drink a Coke and all will be fine. They actually got in trouble for marketing that message, which is completely, you know, incorrect, in the UK. So the UK Advertising Standards Board went after them for making an outright deceptive claim. We'd love to see that kind of action take place here from our federal oversight, but not holding my breath there.
Yeah, I think so, the science on that, to some extent, is like you get about 200 calories or 300 calories from the soft drink, and then you walk your dog and you burn off about 35 calories. I don't think even that sort of violates the laws of thermodynamics. I think, you know, this doesn't really make sense.
It's crazy.
So, you know, ultimately, are you in favor of taxation of bad foods. I mean, this is a very controversial notion. Some people say that's, it's a terrible infringement on freedom, that we should be able to buy stuff and, you know, everyone should have access, and that other people contend that taxes don't work. The taxes, you know, you'd have to, you know, triple the price of something for people to stop buying it. And in fact, I mean, to some extent, that's the case with cigarettes. You know, there's less cigarette smoking. Last time I bought a pack of cigarettes, I think it was like $3. Now I look and it's like $12, and yet there's still a fair number of people who are smoking. So what's up with that?
Did you say there are the same number of people?
No, they're still not the same. Oh, clearly there's less. I mean, there's been a reduction in the number. Yeah. I think the tobacco industry has saved itself by offshoring itself to developing countries.
Yes.
You know, that's how they've saved
it. Well, that's definitely true. Yeah. No, that's definitely true.
But I'm saying what's
definitely huge. Yeah.
I mean, you clearly the taxation's a disincentive, but it's not it's not maybe not the answer.
Well, let's take it step by step. For tobacco, there's no question that taxation has been one of the most important policies and implemented to help reduce consumption in the U.S. and particularly among youth. You're absolutely right. The tobacco industry has gone overseas to make up their dollars, and that's an ethical failing on our part to deal with that. But when it comes to soda and food, it's really a lot more complicated. So, and I've also worked on alcohol taxes, and they've been shown to be effective in alcohol, but we haven't kept up the alcohol taxation in order to continue to be effective. With soda and food, I think the jury's still out. There's certainly some preliminary research to suggest we could see some similar decreases in consumption, say, with a soda tax. And, I'm in favor of it if it can work. Mm-hmm. I think it's complicated, and I think that it's a huge political fight. And, people are experimenting with it. Let's see if it works. I'm okay with that. I think there are all kinds of policy approaches, though, that we need when it comes to food and soda. And, tobacco actually presents a much similar policy approach, right? It's a simple message, don't smoke, and we have few sort of policy levers to help people reduce smoking, and there's really nowhere else to go. People either smoke or they don't. When mm-hmm. it comes to reducing certain kind of soft drink or food consumption, well, there's a lot of options people have, right? So they may cut back on sugary soda. What if they increase their consumption of diet soda? What does that look like from an overall health perspective? We don't know. So, like I said, it's just a much more complicated landscape, but I'm certainly in favor of, we've got a public health crisis on our hands. We definitely need to be trying these different approaches.
Well, one of the problems I have with this, as a professional nutritionist and nutritionally oriented doctor, is that the science just keeps changing. So if in 1980, say, we were to make a list of good versus bad foods, we would have said, okay, let's tax butter, let's tax meat, let's tax high-fat milk, and, low-fat milk would be, cheaper. And yet now the science has sort of caught up with us, and, we have some doubts as to whether it's the saturated fat that creates a problem. We spawned a whole industry of, quote, low-fat foods that may have done us a disservice, and, since the science is not entirely settled, can the government really be the arbiter of what we should be eating?
Right. Well, I hear you. And although, I would disagree. I think the science is still pretty clear that saturated fat from animal products is a problem.
There we will have to respectfully disagree.
But I don't think that low fat was the way to go. If the type of fat matters. And I certainly wouldn't want to be promoting low fat milk over whole fat. I think that's ridiculous. So, to your point about evolving science, like, we're always in that situation, right? I mean, I think that the science is pretty clear that sugar is a problem. It's certainly a problem as far as being in excess in Americans' diet, and that soda is one of the main culprits for that. And there's no nutritional benefit to drinking soda. We can argue about whether that
exactly.
is true. For meat or dairy products, but certainly when it comes to something like soda, and I think that's why the public health world has mostly focused on.
Notwithstanding those great ads, those Super Bowl ads, those great Super Bowl ads, you know, all those soft drink dollars went to those great Super Bowl ads yesterday. You know, so lavish, so expensive, and so, you know, heartwarming. And yet, you know, what's it all about? It's basically about a sugared, flavored, artificial beverage that has nothing to do with anything except the water content, right, which hydrates you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, I agree. I mean, it's not even, as one of my colleagues said, it's not that it has no nutritional value, it has negative nutritional value.
Yeah, exactly.
Value.
Worse than none.
So,
right.
Yeah. You know, it's like it's a place to start.
Yeah. So what's the call to action here? You know, first of all, people can go to Eat Drink Politics. You've got an excellent report, or actually book that they can order, Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. In fact, that book was chosen by a very, very esteemed professor of nutrition, Dr. Marion Nessel, who's been a guest here on my program at New York University here in New York. And she's made it required reading for her nutrition students, and I heartily agree. I think that's a great place to start. So what can the public do, our listeners?
Other than read my book?
Yeah.
Well, they can check out my work at eatdrinkpolitics.com. And like I always say, there's no shortage of ways for people to get involved, and there's really no excuse not to. So, you know, whatever, and it's not enough to simply, you know, eat right or shop at your local farmer's market. That we each have a responsibility to make sure that healthy food choices are available to everyone, not just those of us who are lucky enough to afford it or have access to it. Mm-hmm. So that means looking for where to get involved in your backyard, if it's your school district or low-income neighborhood nearby, seeing what you can do to help out there. And then going out from there, there's plenty of state, regional, national, even international groups that are working to change public policy to make healthy food more available and to curb marketing to children and, you know, so many issues that we need to fix, fix our broken food system. So, you know, I just tell people to look for those opportunities and figure out where you want to plug in, either with, you know, money or volunteer time or, you know, getting on an action listserv to take action when we need to.
Okay, eatdrinkpolitics.com is the place to go. And our guest, Michelle Simon, thank you very much for helping us understand this issue better.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You've just listened to a free podcast brought to you by yours truly and the Hoffman Center. F-R-E-E is my favorite four-letter word, but these podcasts do involve time and money to produce, and so in the spirit of defraying some of our very real production costs and to keep these podcasts flowing, I'd like to ask you to consider a couple of things. First, if you like what you're hearing, please share these podcasts with your friends and relatives. Our object is to continue the spectacular growth of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast with the goal of attaining 250,000 podcast downloads per month in 2014. I know that with the help of dedicated listeners like you, it'll happen. Second, go to drhoffman.com and click on the store and consider buying your supplements via our convenient internet portal or call the Hoffman Center and talk to one of our friendly supplement advisors. We only stock the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere, the very same supplements that I talk about here on Intelligent Medicine and that I prescribe to my patients at the Hoffman Center. And finally, consider becoming a patient at the Hoffman Center. I can personally perform an extensive workup on you, applying all the Intelligent Medicine principles that you hear about on these podcasts, or alternatively, make an appointment with Layla Mutin, our Hoffman Center nutritionist. You already know her as a frequent contributor on Intelligent Medicine, and she'll provide you with expert advice on diet and supplements. Anyway, thanks for listening and continue enjoying our Intelligent Medicine podcasts.